ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Heist movies are one of my favourite genres when they're done well. The satisfaction of a well-laid plan coming off, the tension of a double cross, the chemistry of a few top actors coming together or facing off.
De Niro and Pacino in Heat, Val Kilmer and Robert Downey Jr. in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Sandra Bullock and Cate Blanchett in Ocean's 8.
All amazing options. So why in 2025 is it so damn hard to get it right?
Welcome to the Arts in 30 Weekender on ABC Radio National, where we set the news aside and share our tips on what to check out and what to skip from the world of arts. I'm C. Benedict.
And I'm Sky Kirkham. And this week, I'm diving into the glut of crime films that have been hitting cinemas and streaming services in recent weeks and trying to figure out why they're all so meh. And on the positive side, I'll be recommending The Invocations, a novel that came out late last year but is front of mind again after taking out one of the country's biggest prizes.
First, though, we cannot do this week without talking about Taylor Swift. She has once again dominated the music industry with her new album, The Life of a Showgirl. But does it rise above the awkward references to her fiancé's junk? No. This is her 12th studio album. It is a return to this old producing team. She's working with Max Martin, who is, you know, this hit maker from Days of Yore, produced her very, very successful 1989. I personally had a bit of optimism around this album before it came out because Jack Antonoff, who has been her collaborator for the last quite a few albums, is like my personal nemesis. I think he shaves the edges off all of these really interesting female artists and creates kind of the same music that was getting made 10 years ago, but like a bit worse. Like that's sort of his problem. And I was like, yeah, Taylor Swift, work with someone else. Yes, Max Martin, you're a hit maker. Absolutely. But no, it turns out that Max Martin is also a kind of a boring old person now. Like it's just identical to stuff that was made like 15 years ago, but like not as good.
Well, before we get into the criticisms too deeply, we should at least acknowledge that as far as hit making goes, this has been the biggest sales week ever for one of music's biggest stars. 2.7 million sales last Friday alone in the US of this album. It's already the best-selling album of the year. Hundreds of thousands more in the UK. Again, top-selling album of the year. One of the only albums to have sold more than 100,000 copies, and I think it's already at over 600,000. And it topped the box office with the accompanying film Taylor Swift, The Release Party of a Showgirl. So Taylor Swift remains a singular figure in the world of pop music.
Yeah, I think, I am optimistic that there will be other people that outstrip this over the coming months, because what she's really actually great at is creating a huge range of opportunities for people to give her money and to stream her stuff. I know that it is a cultural event, her releasing a new album, but I honestly feel like this might be the last time it feels like a cultural event, because, I have to tell you that I heard this album for the first time at like a Taylor Swift album listening party, because it was my friend's birthday and I was simply not allowed not to attend. And it involved quite a lot of, you know, listen to a track and then pause between tracks, talk about what we thought the track was about, whether or not we liked it, all of that sort of thing. And these are women in their mid-30s who are all brilliant professionals, and they are retaining so much personal information about Taylor Swift. I cannot tell you.
You're not the biggest Swift fan in the world, but these, your fellow party members, perhaps, are more indicative of the audience.
Well, yeah, I think, it's really important. They want you to know that they're not Swifties, they're Swiftocrats. Which sure. is a distinction, because the Swifties, I think, theoretically think she can do no wrong, whereas the Swiftocrats will critically engage with her work. But I will say, whilst they are critically engaging with her work, they are also just really, really invested or engaged at least with the law, you know, the personal life stuff. Like there was a lyric on one of the songs and said, you know, Abigail told me, and immediately like two people at the party were like, Abigail is her best friend from when she was 14. She lives in this town, blah, 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 blah. Like, why do you know so much about Abigail? Like, this is really amazing. Which is why I think it's not really music. Like it is music on a technical level, but the thing that is happening culturally is an opportunity of coming together. It's more like...
It's the last water cooler moment.
Yeah. Well, yes, hopefully not the last water cooler moment, but it definitely feels like a dying death rattle of water cooler moments. Like it's more like what a big network, like Grey's Anatomy. It's Grey's Anatomy or it's QAnon. Those are the two things that I think it is like, because it is trying to puzzle these little secret bits of her life together and be like, how does she feel about her fiance? How does she feel about Maddie Healy from the 1975? All of these sort of things. And then at the same time, it's, oh my God, she's marrying the football guy and she's going to be, you know, a beautiful wife. It does really feel like it's like an extension of what happened on the Eras tour of people giving each other friendship bracelets. Like it is really about the connection between fans, and Taylor Swift may as well not be a musician or in fact a real person at this point. She's a character.
And the character almost has to be a defense mechanism at this point, right? Because she is one of the most famous people in the world. Like having people listen to your music and be able to say, oh, Abigail, that's her best friend when she was 14. That is a level of personal connection that I cannot even imagine the general public having with my life. Like that feels almost impossible to live with.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely would be, right? But it's also the fact that since she was a teenager, basically, since she was in her very early 20s, if not before that, that part of her personal life has been part of her brand, has been part of her fodder. Like, it is impossible to say how she would extricate herself from that now, despite the fact that she probably wanted to at various points in her career.
And I have to say, I am not a pop person particularly. I can recognize good pop, but it's not a genre I spend a lot of time listening to. Taylor Swift has written some great pop songs over the years. This album really didn't have anything that rises anywhere near the top of the heap for me. There's something as well with that manufactured personality that I find a little unconvincing at this point. There's this attempt to thread the needle between folksy normal girl and incredibly rich, powerful woman who's been famous since she was a teenager. But it never quite leans into the power and the wealth enough to really feel interesting to me. There's a line in one of the songs, what do you possibly get the girl who has everything and nothing all at once? It's a bit like the poor me of it all doesn't really read as convincing. It's not a direct comparison, but for me, someone like The Weeknd, for all of his flaws, does the emptiness of fame a lot more convincingly than Taylor Swift does.
Oh, I think
she does
everyone.
The joy of fame perhaps more.
I think everyone basically does it more convincingly. I'm thinking about the recent Lorde album, Virgin, which has quite a lot of that on it. I'm actually thinking about Charlie XCX and Brat and like the song Sympathy is a Knife, which a lot of people think is about Taylor Swift. And God, we could get into the kind of like battle of the terrible diss tracks with that, but we won't do that now. I mean, Charlie XCX has written some really amazing I'm very anxious because I'm more famous than I used to be kind of songs, as is Lorde, looking at like her public profile and the way that her privacy doesn't belong to her anymore and how money doesn't mean happiness and all of those sort of things. You know, even if you want to just keep it boxed into people who have been produced by Jack Antonoff, she's not even like third on the list, you know?
Oof. All email to both of us. That's fair.
please send your complaints to sky.kirkham.
The best track on this album, I think we both think, is probably Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
It's got like a couple of the little golden Max Martin touches. There's like a tiny little like right-handy piano trill that goes bling, bong, and it's like it has like the juice for a hot second. And she also is using her voice a little bit more in that. Like, one of the really horrific things about the way that Taylor Swift has been like sort of standard down over her last three albums is that we just don't hear that much of her voice anymore. Everything is down here and everything is kind of spoken. And she's never like, she's never in her chest voice at any point in the whole thing. And that's bloody miserable. But Elizabeth Taylor has like a little moment where she's like, and then you're like, oh God, you have a voice underneath all of that, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if we ever will, but I would be very interested to hear a full voice Taylor Swift album again at some point.
I want like proper like country rock. Like I want like a mid-2000s Pink album or like, you know, The Chicks or something, you know, one of those sort of albums where she's like hammering away at the guitar and yodeling into a microphone, because I think she probably could do that. Like, I don't think her voice is why she's become successful, but I think she certainly has access to good vocal coaching.
None of this takes away from Wood, though, which is, if you've read the lyrics, they're pretty bad. I was expecting the track to be better.
Oh, were you?
Well, I was expecting it to be better than the lyrics, and it is not.
It's not. It's really absolutely an extraordinary piece of work. It from someone who has had a really like family-friendly, kind of sexless reputation by and large, with a few diversions, and actually some previous like really interesting kind of not sexual but sexy moments. Like, I'm thinking of Cruel Summer. I'm thinking of some of the stuff on Reputation. You know, she for a while, like, you know, had a bit of sexuality to her. This is someone who has only ever had sex in the missionary position, I've got to tell you. Like, redwood tree, it ain't hard to see, his love was the key that opened my thighs. Like, you are 35 years old. Please stop this.
Poetry it ain't.
Okay, let's go on to something that is beautifully written, shall we? Let's talk about The Invocations.
All right. Yes, changing tack. The Invocations was the winner of the Prime Minister's Literary Award Young Adult category this year. You can hear my interview with the author Crystal Sutherland on an earlier episode of Arts in 30, but we didn't really have a chance to dive into the book during that conversation. The challenges of a relatively fast-paced news show restrict how deep you can go. So I wanted a bit of a chance to rave about it, because it's a really good page-turner YA that I think is going to appeal to a lot of people. It's at the older end of, I think, what is considered young adult. The characters are, I think, 17 years old. I think all of them. But honestly, they feel a bit older than that. They feel more like 20. It's not really a criticism, it's just a vibe of the thing. It explores a lot of ideas in really interesting ways. It's kind of about witchcraft and the patriarchy, women's safety and the cost of power. And it follows three central characters. A curse writer called Ema, a young woman Zara whose sister was killed, and a rich heiress who's been estranged from her family after a self-created curse has gone horribly, horribly wrong. And her name is Jude. And they come together and bond because someone is killing witches and they need to figure out what's going on. And the form of magic that Sutherland has created in this book is, I think, really interesting, because magic in this world exists, but it's restricted to women. Only women can use magic. And it's not the sort of wave a wand, giant magic powers that you'll find in a lot of fantasy books. All of the powers that people get are really limited. They're limited to one ability. They're quite restricted. It's nothing huge and earth-shattering. And there is a terrible price to pay, because how it works is the woman sells basically a part of her soul to a demon who gets attached to her and eats her soul and cuts years off her life, makes her feel less well. In exchange, she gets a certain amount of power. And so a lot of the book is asking the question, what makes it worth making that trade? And none of these women are seeking power. they're all seeking safety. They're all seeking safety from abusive relationships or from a society that leaves them feeling unsafe. And then many of them are killed in turn by witch hunters who are the patriarchy made manifest. So it's, you know, there's a lot of deep themes, societal reflection going on, but it's actually just a really fun page-turning book with a group of central characters trying to figure out who a serial killer is and survive the danger that they find themselves in because of it.
That's a really, like, strong collection of stories that have those sort of, like, women with specific powers as part of the world building. Like, I'm thinking of Octavia Butler and The Power by Naomi Alderman. There's a really good series by Juno Dawson as well, which I'm trying to remember the name of right now. I think it's Coven, which is basically, like, like the craft, but, you know, fun Gen Z trans girls. It's fun.
Yeah, and this has a bit of that as well. The characters, there's not the... One of the traps that a lot of young adult fiction has fallen into as it's become an increasingly popular genre is the romantic triangle, usually featuring a female central character, two male love interests, and... You know, there are books where it really works, but it's become such a trope of the genre that it is really quite dull. And look, I am somewhat biased. My partner is doing a PhD on this genre, so I'm well aware of the good and the bad of what happens in young adult fiction. But this one doesn't have that typical romantic triangle. There is some tension between the characters. Some of them are queer, some of them aren't. But it's largely about friendship. It's largely about their relationship in the world and within the mystery. So there's enough sort of interpersonal dynamics to keep it interesting, but it doesn't derail the story or just lead into very heteronormative romance at the cost of everything else. The other thing that the novel does really well is it goes between the viewpoints of the three central characters, and there's not a huge difference in their viewpoint, but there's enough that they all feel very distinct and that they all feel like they have a very distinct position in the world and view of the world. And I think that's surprisingly hard to do, to manage a difference between your point of view characters who... that it doesn't feel so different as to be a gimmick, but it does feel distinct and unique. And I think Crystal Sutherland's done a really good job on this book. I'm not surprised that it's getting the recognition that it has.
It's really wonderful that it is getting recognized. I cannot wait to read it based on your review. You're listening to the Arts in 30 Weekender. I'm C. Benedict.
And I'm Skye Kirkham.
And Skye, you have caught quite a few of the kind of genre of caper films recently. Can you run us through them before we talk about why they are crumbling?
I can. And I want to begin, as I said at the top of the episode, I love a good caper film. I think we both agree on that.
And one of the better genres.
But in the year 2025, there's been a whole bunch of them released over a very short period of time, and none of them are great. So the three I've seen in the past couple of weeks are Play Dirty, which is the new film by Shane Black, who did Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys. It stars Mark Wahlberg, and it's based on the Parker series of novels. The second one is Caught Stealing, which is directed by Darren Aronofsky, starring Austin Butler. And the third is Eenie Meenie, which is by a debut director, Sean Simmons, and stars Samara Weaving, who deserves better. and watching the three of them, none of them are terrible, I want to say. And a couple of them are even like, they're fun, they're fine. They're a bit too long, but they're fine. But it really made me appreciate the ones that do the genre really well. Even if we set aside the genuine classics like Heat or Rafifi, the Ocean series of films, Inside Man, even Guy Ritchie, I would say, has an ability to just make a really entertaining, at their best, entertaining couple of hours. It also made me appreciate the ones that are trying to do something different. And the one I have seen this year that does that is Kelly Reichardt's new film, The Mastermind, which I didn't love at the time. But having seen these three films, I'm really revising my opinion and I'm impressed by what she's done there.
And that's like a very wild turn for her as well, because her films are so spacious and slow.
You know. Oh, it's still that.
Yeah. But it's kind of like spinning towards something that's a bit plottier, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's what if Kelly Reichardt did a heist film, which is a really interesting combination.
Is it like 4 hours long? Like there's maybe 45 seconds of plot in any single one of her films, so I cannot imagine how long this takes to spin out.
No, it's 2 hours. There's probably still only like 10 minutes of plot in the film. It is actually really good looking back on it. What do you see love about a heist or a caper film? What are the things that make it work for you?
Well, the thing that I have been really thinking about with like this list of films versus the list of ones that I think are sort of modern but not super contemporary classics is that we're kind of missing that like mid-budget blockbuster, like the ones that are not genuinely like studded with stars like the Ocean series, but also not the ones that are sort of really scrappy independent films. You just want basically quite famous people who've done a lot of acting to be put in a room together and like do something. And the thing that I think really makes one of these films work is the chemistry between the characters. And, you know, that's the reason that the Soderbergh Ocean's like series, it just works so well, because they get gorgeous men to be slightly homoerotic together. Actually, that, you know, that's why Heat's so good. It's why a lot of these films work, isn't it?
The Ocean's film also feel like everyone involved in that film really enjoyed making it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I feel like...
Backstage caper.
Oh, yeah. It feels like the good vibes just resonate off the screen in that film. Now, all three of these that I've seen, so again, that's Play Dirty, Caught Stealing, and Eeny Meeny, are saved to some extent by the performances.
Including Mark Wahlberg?
Not including Mark Wahlberg.
Okay.
He's not the problem, but he's also not the solution. Mm. But they're all kind of let down by the script and the plotting. And I'd say, interestingly, one of the biggest problems is all of them are longer than they should be. And this is a genre that I think is best served by a really tightly told story. Unless you're aiming to be, you know, Heat, Usual Suspects, Best of the Best, I think you need to know that you should be about 90 to 100 minutes and everything needs to be quite tight. The other challenge these have is both Play Dirty and Caught Stealing don't handle their competing tones particularly well. They both try and merge comedy and serious drama, and neither of them do it particularly well, which leaves both of the vibes feeling out of place. So as I was mentioning, Play Dirty draws on the Parker series, who's a famous pulp criminal, whole bunch of books. He's extremely competent. He's involved in tightly written stories of heist. They're usually about 200 pages or less. There's lots of double cross and revenge, but he's always the man with the plan. He doesn't get emotionally attached. He knows when to walk away, when to do violence, when to take revenge. The film, on the other hand, is kind of flabby and sets a loose version of that character against Shane Black's typical comedy and humorous incompetence, which I absolutely love in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, but is a really weird vibe against Mark Wahlberg playing an emotionless, competent guy who won't let things get in his way.
See, that's like,
except everyone he surrounds himself with, apparently.
Yeah, that's like such a classic casting problem as well, that you want to do something, because I would really argue that that balancing act between the comedy and the drama is like totally integral to the genre. And if you pace it well enough, fast enough, and have enough going on, that tonal whiplash is actually like one of the things that kind of pushes you forward in the story. And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, like talking about Shane Black, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is perfect at that. There are moments in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I mean, I saw that when I was a teenager, I think. And there are moments that I remember as like being genuine sort of... There's a couple of things that are genuinely harrowing in it. There's a couple of moments of misery. There's like the reality of being a woman in a world of violence in amongst all of these very silly dick jokes. There's a gun inside someone's bum at one point, but it all kind of works together because everything was so perfectly deployed. But it is such a balancing act, and it doesn't surprise me that it absolutely fails to come to fruition in 9 times out of 10, you know?
Yeah, it's a shame, though, because Shane Black has pulled it off, particularly as a writer, quite a lot. The Nice Guys, I would argue, is really good as well. He was also behind The Long Kiss Goodnight, which I think is a very underrated 90s action film. He did the Lethal Weapon films. So he has pulled that tonal combination off a lot of times in a career, far more than most people will. But this one is a letdown, unfortunately.
What about Caught Stealing? Because I would say that some of my favorite caper films are Guy Ritchie's like not amazing Sherlock Holmes films, which are really fun. And again, there's a really important homoerotic tension between the lead characters that keeps it going.
They are really fun. Caught Stealing has none of that. And it is, it's kind of interesting in that it really is Darren Aronofsky doing a Guy Ritchie film. Aronofsky, of course, the person behind and the man behind Requiem for a Dream, among other films. And this film really leans into like substance abuse problems and addiction and PTSD and all of the psychological complexity that Aronofsky has been interested in throughout his career. But it's in a like violent, silly crime film. The bigger problem, though, for this one, I think, is the central character is actually fundamentally a good guy who gets involved in the situation by what is basically a case of mistaken identity. But then truly terrible things happen to him and everyone around him. One of the reasons I think the Guy Ritchie films work so well, maybe less the Sherlock and more the Lockstock era,
sure.
is that it's bad people having terrible things happen to them, so you don't have to feel bad when it happens to them. And the central characters are kind of like lovable rogue kind of bad, and only kind of bad things happen to them, and they kind of get away with it in the end. This one, it's like the guy in the center of it's really nice, and really terrible things happen to him and everyone around him. And it plays it quite, he gets the shit kicked out of him near the start of the film and ends up in hospital and loses a kidney. And that's played as like quite serious. So yes, that is what happens when you are beaten up by mobsters. But that doesn't really work in a film where the rest of the film is playing the violence for laughs. So yeah, it's a tonal problem, I think. Austin Butler's really charming and nice, but I feel like the film needs more of a Brad Pitt weirdo playing that role.
I do think our sort of young leading men at the moment, like of which Austin Butler is maybe the head of the pack, are very boyish in comparison to the sort of Clooney wave, you know?
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I don't know, you kind of don't want anything that bad to happen to them. And you're like, oh, well, if you just sit down and recover from your kidney operation in hospital, that would be lovely.
Yes. It's a shame, though, because there is a lot to like in this film. Matt Smith plays a UK anarchist punk and is delightful. There are these, again, played kind of for laughs, Hasidic mobsters played by Liev Schreiber and Vincent D'Onofrio in a really fun cameo. There's some nicely shot action and it's fun. It just, it's a little long and it's a little, I left it feeling kind of bad, which I don't feel is the vibe you want to walk out of a caper film with.
No, although it's actually the vibe I've walked out of every Aronofsky film with, you know.
That's
like,
that's
I didn't
fair.
Feel great after Requiem for a Dream, certainly not after Black Swan.
No one felt great after either
of those
films.
What about Mother? Do you remember that?
Oh, not happily. That was not his best.
No. In a crowded field of not that good, actually.
Well, I actually really, Requiem for a Dream is one of my favorite films in a I never want to see it again kind of way.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean by that. I think I saw it when I was just slightly too young, and I think maybe I am still recovering from that, you know.
That's fair. Of the three films I mentioned, Eeny Meeny is probably the worst of the lot, and its main
I've
problem
forgotten about it,
is know? That it's kind of boring. Samara Weaving deserves better is the only thing I will say about that film. Someone please give her a role that she actually is worthy of.
Yeah, it's been a long time since, what Ready was it called? Not. Ready or Not. Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, she really suffers from the fact that she looks identical to Margot Robbie, doesn't she?
She does.
And we already have one of her.
We do. But the one thing the Eeny Meeny is a good reminder that Samara Weaving is still the actress who is in Ready or Not and can still carry a film even if it's not a very good one. So come on, Hollywood, give her something else.
And if you'd like to talk about how much you enjoy the work of Samara Weaving, or in fact anything else, you can email us artsin30@abc.net.au.
And remember, you can catch the main Arts in 30 show every Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. here on Radio National, or anytime at all on the ABC Listen app. I'm Sky Kirkham.
I'm C. Benedict.
And we'll catch you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.